Welcome to Medicus, a student-run podcast about any and all things in the world of medicine. Follow along as we interview outstanding individuals about important topics in healthcare. Hi, guys, and welcome back to Medicus. My name is Rasa, and today I am joined by Dr. Cassandra Ma, who is a psychologist and founder of Reclaim 13, a Chicago-based nonprofit that seeks to end the cycle of sexual exploitation. Hi, Dr. Ma. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you for inviting me.
Can you tell our listeners a bit more about yourself, touching on your upbringing, education, and training?
So I'm a trained clinical psychologist, and I also did my postdoctoral fellowship in marriage and family therapy, which is what I ultimately ended up doing professionally for many years. I used to teach and help graduate students learn how to become marriage and family therapists, primarily with the goal of being able to help families that I had seen the product of later, their adolescence. I had seen these kids who were already starting to be re-victimized as well as abusing other people. And so I really wanted to work and focus on families with young children so I could help these, help our families grow up healthier earlier. And so that was my background. And then I left my job to really, really just look for victims is really what I was intending to do. And then started Reclaim 13 in 2012.
Amazing. What inspired you to shift the focus of your career from the clinical psychology work you initially envisioned yourself doing to addressing sex trafficking?
Yeah, so I never planned to do that. I went to a dinner. I was, as I mentioned, I was teaching and supervising and loved what I had my own clinical practice and I loved what I was doing. Went to a fundraising dinner for an organization that works in developing countries that works to rescue victims from human trafficking, mostly children. And at this fundraising dinner, the executive director talked about these very young children, as young as 5 and 6, were being trafficked and exploited. And he happened to focus on Southeast Asia and Cambodia. And I went to work the next day. I was working fairly far, over an hour away from where I live. And so drove up there to work. And I remember looking at the clock in Evanston, and I remember saying, it's 9 a.m. here in Evanston, and it's 9 p.m. where I had just heard about these kiddos who are about to start a night of hell. And it was one of those moments where I think of it as my calling, but it was one of those moments where it just, everything I was doing didn't make sense to me. And so I finished my year there. I went to look for kids. I had heard the thing that people were talking about at that point in time is that the most vulnerable children to trafficking are the kids who are running away from home. And so I took my car, I went downtown and looked in all the places where I was told these kids were buses, train stations, and figured that at least I could help these kids before they were approached by predators. And it wasn't the smartest plan to, there was really no after plan, you know, what I would do with them if I did find them. So I remember talking with my pastor and we looked into what it would mean to start a nonprofit. And that's how, really how we got started, unintentionally.
So before we dive too much deeper into the conversation, can you define human trafficking? And are human trafficking and sex trafficking synonymous, or are they slightly different? We can just clear those terms up.
That's a really great question. So simply put, human trafficking is when one person who or many people, traffickers, take a person and use and exploit them for one of two purposes. There's two primary categories. There's quite a few subcategories, but the two main categories in human trafficking are sex trafficking and labor trafficking. And so the traffickers would take a human being, another person, whether it's a child or an adult, and exploit them for labor or for sex purposes. And in so doing, there's a exchange of benefits component to this, which usually means money. The exchange of money, or sometimes it's drugs, for the services to a third party. So it's usually thought of as a three-party type of situation.
Where only two parties benefit.
Exactly. Exactly.
Like you mentioned in what inspired you this talk, you know, when many of us think about trafficking, we likely envision this happening in some poor country far away across the globe. But of course, this is not the case. So can you discuss human trafficking on the local and global context? And are there factors to consider when attempting to address this in different locales?
That's a great question. And because I mentioned that I heard about what was happening in Southeast Asia, the picture here is very different. We talk a lot about the systemic factors that relate to how trafficking looks in any particular country, or community or even state for that matter, it varies dramatically differently. For example, it's not as easy to use a kidnapping strategy that you might find in a developing country where the kids are just frankly just picked up off the roads and taken away. Because we have Amber Alerts, our phones go off. And so we have all sorts of things in place that protect children from those types of approaches. So traffickers or people who are unscrupulous and exploiting other human beings and think that that's an okay thing to do will adjust their tactics. And so in our country, the more common way that kids in particular or victims are pulled into this is through a grooming process. So we call this a relational trauma, in that the traffickers will typically build a relationship. The traffickers are somehow usually known. Oftentimes to the kids, they're known in some fashion.
So what makes someone vulnerable to human trafficking?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are so many factors that make kids vulnerable, and even more nowadays with the internet. So there's a lot of online grooming that we're seeing increasingly. I tend to think any child is vulnerable because any child needs all the same things. Children are dependent upon adults to care for them and protect them. And so I tend to think that. But in terms of sort of major factors, poverty is certainly one. The factor that we focus a lot on that is the common in almost all the histories of the kids that we've worked with is sexual abuse. So earlier victimization in a child's life makes a child extraordinarily more vulnerable for this particular type of crime as well. And then, you know, there's low self-esteem, but again, like, you know, what kid doesn't have that? So there's a lot of those types of variables that I think everybody has. And like I said, with the onset of the, you know, online social media and all these other ways that people can connect with one another, that is an increasingly grave problem that sort of levels the playing field in terms of socioeconomic status and vulnerability.
Yeah. So it's really important, obviously, to have organizations like Reclaim 13 that really help these populations that can't advocate for themselves and are victim to these traumas that have been present their entire lives, really. So can you talk more about the mission of Reclaim 13 and, you know, what inspired you to start it? I know you mentioned a little bit about that at the beginning. And then the cycle of exploitation that you kind of talked about, if you could just elaborate on that.
Absolutely. So the cycle of sexual exploitation starts with sexual abuse or some sort of sexual exploitation early in the child's life. And so the kids that we work with, you know, the youngest victim that we have in our clinic who was sexually abused is a one-year-old. So it starts very young for children, the sexual abuse. And then that makes a child more vulnerable to every single sort of victimization, including trafficking and exploitation and further re-victimization in the course of their life. And so that's really the cycle that we're seeking to break. The last part of that that we are just starting to develop some programming around is that when you have grown up and you haven't had any intervention, then that person grows up to become a parent who is parenting from a lens of trauma as well. And so not being able to see any of those things, see any of the signs, know how to parent appropriately, makes the child of that person, that survivor, very vulnerable to, again, being victimized as well. And so that's really our mission. Our mission is to forge healing pathways for survivors of child victimization, particularly child sexual abuse and child sex trafficking.
That's a beautiful mission. And I really commend you on the work that you're doing because it's much needed and I think rarely talked about, even among, you know, medical professionals. On your website for Reclaim 13, it states that you work in three areas to end the cycle of exploitation. So education, healing, and community. Can you elaborate on these?
So education, we have a prevention program. That's actually where we started. I would go to schools and talk with kids, and we have a prevention program that spans all the way from pre-K all the way up through high school to help kids know about this very topic that you're educating people on, so that they can be safe. Our goal is that all children can grow up feeling safe and loved and that no child should have to go through that. So where prevention and education is very critical. We also have a new healthcare education team that consists of many medical students, actually, and Dr. Lowe, who's a pediatrician. She leads that team in helping our hospital partnerships and our hospital partners to know how to identify as well as sort of create a plan or if a victim is identified. Our healing programs consist of several different components, but two of them are our residential programs. We have residential programs because one of the greatest needs in this battle against trafficking is for victims to be able to have a place, a safe place that they can heal in, not on the streets, not knocked back at their homes. And so we have Cherish House, which is a safe house for children who are open trafficked between the ages of 10 and 17. We have Courage House, which is a transitional program for 18 to 25-year-olds who have been trafficked, helping them with the life skills. And, you know, one of our kids is going to college, so helping them kind of take those next steps into adulthood. We also have what we call our Child and Family Program, which is our community-based program with mentorship and all the things that survivors need to be able to make it if residential is not something that they need. Kind of like an outpatient program component. We also then work in the community with, we have a therapy clinic as well that serves not only just that population that we referenced many times, but really the general public.
That's so many programs. And are all of these free of charge to the victims?
Yeah, all of those programs that we mentioned are free of charge.
That's amazing. I mean, obviously it's a nonprofit, so you must have to do a lot of work to gather resources and funding because, I mean, I know you're thinking about a residential facility from a medical standpoint, like those can be very expensive. And if you have physician on staff, you know, other professional providers, a lot of work goes into gathering these funds.
You're absolutely right. We have a great partnership, by the way, with Loyola, who provides medical care, so a pediatric care for our kids, which is a beautiful thing. And that's how we're able to do a lot of things that we wouldn't ordinarily be able to do, which is through amazing partnerships and support of community providers.
How can healthcare professionals ensure that they provide appropriate care to victims of sexual trafficking?
That's a great question. So what you're doing is exactly what I think is the first and most important step, which is to become educated about the problem. As long as people think that this is, like you said, which is the common myth, a problem that just occurs over there or somewhere else and not in our hospitals, then we won't see the signs. But when your eyes are open, you'll see these kids and these individuals everywhere. Not that every single situation is that, but you will see the warning signs of someone who's in trouble and can't articulate their need for help.
What are some unique health challenges faced by these victims?
There are many, and it's interesting because our pediatricians have had an opportunity to see our kids from the beginning. Certainly, so some of the things you might expect, like with sexually transmitted infections, those types of things are vulnerabilities that our kids come with, pregnancy, all the things that come with the sexual abuse of a child, and then all the physical damage. Many of our kids have gastrointestinal issues from the sexual abuse and, you know, a whole host of things. Then there's also the psychiatric issues of the trauma and how that, you probably know much better than I do, just in terms of how that impacts the developing brain. And that child's creates further vulnerabilities again if those things are not addressed.
Yeah, 100%. What are trauma-informed practices that physicians can implement to improve health outcomes?
So, you know, one of the biggest things that we hear from our kids is really just being believed. In fact, I just spoke yesterday with one of our victims who's a survivor, who's a young adult now, and she went to her psychiatrist, and her psychiatrist didn't even believe her and wanted proof. And it was just the most devastating thing for her not to be believed. And so I think that's a start. I certainly think we have so many compassionate healthcare professionals as, you know, you're trying to educate people. And the other thing that I always talk with people about is the experiences of one of our girls. She shared with me that she had gone into a hospital and the medical team probably recognized something was going on. They recognized the signs, which was awesome. They asked her the appropriate questions. Are you afraid? And she wasn't there with her perpetrator. He let her go to the hospital. And after there was some physical damage from the abuse, but he let her go to the hospital. So she was by herself. So it wasn't because he was there, but she said, no, to all the questions, are you afraid? No. Do you need help? No. And I asked her, you know, because she did really want to get out of that situation. But what it helped me to understand, and this is perhaps something just to keep in mind, it may not be right at that moment that you are able to help that person, but if you give them resources, your phone number or some way that they can reach out later when they're able to, what I understood from her that's been so eye-opening is that when our survivors are in such a chronic hyperarousal state, they're just constantly in fear. They don't recognize. So she was answering as honestly as she could. She was answering, no, she's not afraid, because she didn't recognize it. And so, again, it's maybe not at that point in time to not be discouraged, but if you can put something in their hands, we have bracelets, for example, that have our hotline number on it. Mm-hmm. If you can put something in that person's hands that they can take home and somehow hide it so that later on when they're in those tough moments, it's a little bit like domestic violence,
yeah,
then they can reach out for help and you'll be there.
Yeah, I think a couple of things that you said. One, definitely the fact that we just have to believe victims. It takes so much courage to come forth and state that, you know, there's a problem, that I can't imagine the feeling of not being believed when you've worked up, again, all of this courage to be able to say that. And then the other thing that you said, I can understand, I mean, in a way, right? I haven't experienced this, but I can understand kind of being so accustomed to, like you said, this feeling that they have. This is just their life, the way that they're mm-hmm. living. So it's almost like they don't know what can be out there that's not this. And so I think making sure that they know that they can come back to you is probably a critical piece.
Absolutely. I think that's well put. Yep.
So how can our listeners who are primarily pre-medical and medical students help in putting an end to human trafficking?
Just what you said and summarized so beautifully is I think we have to think long-term, sort of long game. Like we may not be that person who gets to get that exciting part of rescuing or helping that person or getting them out of that place. But, you know, even like when we are working with them in the safe house, we have them safe, but there are still so many obstacles. And so, you know, we talk about planting seeds. We each have a part in planting seeds in the person's life. And the biggest thing that I think that we can all do is to show these victims that there are people who care. That speaks such volume to any person who's been victimized beyond what, you know, even traditional therapy like that I would do can do for somebody, because being believed, being heard and being understood, or just somebody being compassionate with you when you're going through these things, I think is probably the biggest thing that we can all do that's very easy for anybody to do.
Absolutely. And where can people go to find out more about human trafficking and your work specifically in preventing sexual exploitation?
Yeah, so we're on all the social media outlets, you know, the Facebook and Instagram, all those things. We also have a website, reclaim13.org. We have a hotline that's accessible by healthcare professionals, but also victims themselves, 24-hour hotline that's on our website. I can give you that number if you want. But there are a myriad of ways that we try to make our services as accessible as possible, and are happy to talk with anybody about, you know, how they could get involved. We have, I think, over 150 volunteers right now. And so many people involved, like I said, medical people, students, and anybody who, because I started out as a volunteer, and we are a volunteer-led organization for the first 3 years, over 3 years. We are very passionate about the fact that anybody can do something. And we try very hard to make a lot of different opportunities for anybody to engage at whatever level or time commitment or skill level.
Yeah, it's an overwhelming problem, but having a lot of us come together to try and tackle it, it makes it seem a lot less daunting.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Ma, for coming on the show and really enlightening us on this topic and ways that we can be better providers and just better people in helping these victims. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you for what you're doing. You know, someday you guys are going to be the ones who are going to be seeing these victims and helping them. So I'm encouraged. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode. This wouldn't be possible without the support from our listeners. Please rate, review, and subscribe. We appreciate donations to help fund the production of this podcast. To support us, go to medicuspodcast.com, where you can additionally find show notes, links, and information about our guests. We are at Medicus Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. If you have any questions, comments, or episode suggestions, please submit them on our website. This podcast is intended for general information purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine. No patient-doctor relation is formed, and the content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Views and opinions are their own and do not represent any organization.